Sorry, fellow Republicans, you can't spin your way out of this one.
But they are going to try, aren't they? I think they're gonna.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the airwaves and the internet around the country and the world. Blanketing planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. All right, first up, we've got a lot to get to, so let's jump right into the one good piece of good news, that's what I'm trying to say, that we may have to offer you today.
I'm all for it.
Although that's not true. We got a green news report coming up later. Those are always chocked
with good
but news.
Good news.
There, hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
There is, or maybe was, we will see, just one outstanding, undecided, or at least still challenged election result from the 2024 elections, which, for the record, was 6 months ago yesterday. And yet there is or was still one election, one race being challenged. I know it seems like it was 10 years ago, but it was only 6 months ago. Still, 6 months is a long time for an election to go undecided, or at least to still be facing challenge in the courts. But that is, or maybe was, we will see, the situation in the North Carolina Supreme Court election, which we have been covering for much of those 6 months. An election where incumbent state Supreme Court Justice Allison Riggs, a Democrat, was, or maybe still is, being challenged by a Republican lower court judge by the name of Jefferson Griffin in the very narrowly divided state where Trump won in 2024, even as Democrats won pretty much all of the other major statewide elections last year, including governor, lieutenant governor, state attorney general, and yes, for the one seat, they won the one seat that was up for grabs on the state Supreme Court, where Republicans nonetheless already outnumber Democrats by a 5-2 margin. That's the margin, the Republican margin, even if Democratic Justice Riggs hangs on to her seat. Still, Republicans, they had a playbook that they had prepared to apparently challenge presidential results in the state if Donald Trump had lost it last year. So no reason to let a good, if massively vote-suppressing playbook go unused, I guess, particularly in an election where, after at least two recounts requested by the Republican Griffin, the state election board confirmed and the state's governor, they all certified that Riggs had won the election, if by a very, very narrow 734-vote margin. 734 votes out of more than 5.5 million votes cast last year, but those were the results. Them's the numbers. But narrow or not, it's a win. A win is a win. But not if you are the Republican Party in North Carolina, apparently, where Griffin and the GOP have been challenging those results ever since. Jefferson Griffin had alleged that some 65,000 votes were cast unlawfully last year and they must be tossed out, claiming that many vote-by-mail voters did not have a driver's license or social security number attached to their voter registration records, so their votes were cast unlawfully, as he argued, even though many of those votes, the biggest chunk of the challenged 65,000 voters, had either registered to vote in North Carolina long before that became a requirement, or they did submit a social security or driver's license number with their registration, but state officials failed to add it to their record. Or there was a typo, something that was not the voter's fault. In other words, the problem with their voter registration records was not their fault, but Griffin and the Republicans wanted to toss out their votes anyway. But, by the way, only in the Supreme Court race. All of the other voters on the ballots of the votes on the ballots of those very same voters, apparently, those would be allowed to stand. Only the Supreme Court race would they lose their vote. Would hate to, you know, reverse the results of any other close races accidentally in North Carolina, even though all of this is clearly absurd and unconstitutional, etc. There were two other classes of voters among those 65,000 that Republicans had been hoping to disenfranchise from last year's election after they had already voted. They are both of them smaller groups of voters, but still they compromise several thousand voters, which if their votes were also disqualified, that would still potentially be enough to reverse the results of a race, you know, with a 734 vote margin. One class of voters, one of the two, are overseas voters who never actually lived in North Carolina, so-called never residents. For example, two North Carolina voters may move overseas for work, or maybe one or both are serving in the military, and they are allowed to vote via absentee ballot. Then they have a child while they're overseas who is also considered, at least until Griffin's challenge, to be a North Carolina resident who may vote in North Carolina's elections when they turn 18. And then the other group, that's about, I think, 800 or 900 of those. And then the other group is members of the military or other overseas residents who voted but failed to include a copy of their photo ID as only recently required by state law and not adequately told or told at all to those voters, those overseas military voters, in advance of the election. So long story short, the challenge to those 65,000 voters by Jefferson Griffin and the Republicans was culled down to just those overseas residents who never lived in North Carolina, the so-called never residents, and a few thousand military voters. The radical right-wing Republican state Supreme Court, with its 5-2 Republican advantage, which actually was a 5-1 Republican advantage because Justice Riggs had the decency to recuse herself from the proceedings at the high court in this case that had to do with her, those Republicans on the high court actually allowed this ridiculous challenge by Griffin. But they mandated that those voters who might see their votes tossed, at least they should have the right to try and cure the deficiencies with their ballots or their registrations before they were tossed entirely. Even though the Republican court allowed just a few weeks for local officials to contact all of those voters somehow and somehow have them come in or mail in additional materials needed to ensure that their votes from an election 6 months ago would actually count. So if all of this sounds absolutely ridiculous, it is only because it is absolutely ridiculous. Which, at least as of Monday, a federal court judge now appears to agree with and hopefully, finally, mercifully, putting an end to. A federal judge has ordered the North Carolina State Board of Elections to certify Democrat Allison Riggs as the winner of the 2024 state Supreme Court election. That, according to the Carolina Journal last night, in a decision that rejects the idea of rejecting ballots by the Republican candidate Jefferson Griffin. U.S. Chief District Judge Richard Myers of the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of North Carolina placed a 1-week hold on his decision to allow Griffin time to appeal. That was nice of him. Judge Richard Myers is a Donald Trump appointee. But Myers rejected the state Supreme Court decision in April that placed at least 1,675 and as many as 5,700 ballots from the fall election in question after the state's highest court endorsed this ballot cure process to deal with the disputed ballots. Quote, "It is ordered, adjudged, and decreed that the 1. Retroactive invalidation of absentee ballots cast by overseas military and civilian voters violates those voters' substantive due process rights. 2. The cure process violates the equal protection rights of overseas military and civilian voters. And 3. The lack of any notice or opportunity for eligible voters to contest their mistaken designation as never residents violates procedural due process and represents an unconstitutional burden on the right to vote," Judge Myers, the Trump appointee, wrote. He continued, quote, "It is further ordered, adjudged, and decreed that the State Board of Elections shall not take any action in furtherance of the North Carolina Court of Appeals and Supreme Court's orders." Which is also good news, because Republicans, who still control the gerrymandered state legislature in North Carolina, the unlawfully gerrymandered state legislature in North Carolina, in an attempted power grab from the state's Democratic governor, Josh Stein, those Republicans in the legislature have recently wrestled control of the State Board of Elections from the governor, whose party used to have the majority, to the state legislature, which is run by Republicans. So the Democratic majority on the State Board of Elections has just now, over the last day or two, I think, been switched from Democratic to Republican. So the move to order them to take no action in furtherance of what the Republican state Supreme Court has said is also very important. The federal judge's order here, the Trump-appointed federal judge's order to the state board, is important, even though the state board had previously gone to court to argue in favor of the certification of the Democrat after multiple recounts. The state board had actually been one of the parties in the lawsuits trying to say that Allison Riggs, that she won the election. Myers wrote, quote, "The state board shall certify the results of the election based on the tally at the completion of the canvassing period on December 10 of 2024, confirming Riggs' lead." The judge wrote, quote, "The court wishes to make clear that this case is not about the prerogative of North Carolina courts to interpret North Carolina law. Without question, those courts are the principal expositors of state law," he wrote. "This case is also not about North Carolina's primacy to establish rules for future state elections. It may do so. Rather," he notes, "this case concerns whether the federal constitution permits a state to alter the rules of an election after the fact and apply those changes retroactively to only a select group of voters, and in doing so, treat those voters differently than other similarly situated individuals. This case is also," he said, "about whether a state may redefine its class of eligible voters, but offer no process to those voters who may have been misclassified as eligible." In other words, some voters may have been characterized, for example, as never residents, even though they were at some point a resident. But the state high court's scheme gives them no easy way to demonstrate as much. They were being afforded no constitutional due process.
Where have I heard that before?
Yeah, to put it into, you know, terms of a phrase that seems to be coming up a lot lately, doesn't it, for some reason? To this court, Judge Myers wrote, "The answer to each of those questions is no. They may not do those things." The judge ordered the elections board not to take any other action besides certifying the results, that's it. The, quote, retroactive invalidation of military and overseas ballots would be a violation of those voters' due process rights, he said. So now Justice Riggs, the election board, the state Democratic Party, and other outside groups who had urged Judge Meyer to rule that federal law prevents election officials from tossing any votes at this stage in the electoral process, it looks like they have been successful. Judge Myers agreed with them, and he rejected Griffin and the Republicans' call to allow the state Supreme Court's decision to stand. The lawyers for Riggs wrote to the judge, quote, changing the election rules after the votes have been cast and counted is wrong and unconstitutional. So, too, is targeting military and overseas voters who happen to register in a Democratic-leaning county. Yes. Griffin apparently was challenging only those voters who registered in certain counties.
Insanity.
Even if other voters in Republican counties had the same deficiencies with their ballots, they wouldn't be challenged. That's how ridiculous all of this was, or is. We'll see if Republicans decide to appeal. But it also gives us a peek, I think, at what we might have been looking at had Donald Trump lost last year in states like North Carolina, where clearly these challenges were very well constructed and put together. These challenges to certain voters were obviously prepared in advance, likely of Election Day. The judge said, you establish the rules before the game. You don't change them after the game is done. Even some Republicans in the state had gotten tired of all of this, criticizing Griffin's efforts to overturn his loss, including Pat McCrory. Yes, the last Republican governor of the state, who delivered a message on a local PBS station on a segment called Unspun, calling out his fellow Republicans for this entire affair just about 2 weeks ago.
Months after Election Day, Republicans in Raleigh are still spinning in the race for North Carolina's Supreme Court. It's the only election in the country that still hasn't been decided. Democrat Allison Riggs beat Republican Jefferson Griffin by 735 votes. But Griffin is suing to have thousands of ballots, mostly from military families stationed overseas, tossed out. Those are the facts. Now here's the spin. Republicans say those votes for Supreme Court don't count because overseas military voters didn't show ID. In fact, the state never even asked them for ID. But the rules in this election were the same as in previous elections, approved by both Republicans and Democrats, and except for Jefferson, not one other candidate in either party, winner or loser, this year or previous years, has asked for those overseas military votes not to be counted. Look, I'm a Republican. I supported Jefferson for Supreme Court. I wanted him to win, but spinning your way into a Supreme Court seat isn't the way to do it. If you change the rules in this election, after the election is over, then every election could be in doubt in the future. So here's my spin on North Carolina's election for the Supreme Court. If those same overseas military votes counted for president and Congress and governor and legislators and county commissioners and all the other judges who were elected, then why shouldn't they count for the Supreme Court race? Sorry, fellow Republicans, you can't spin your way out of this one.
So if you've lost Pat McCrory at this point, sleazy former Republican governor of North Carolina,
then you know you may be going down the wrong road here. I mean, also, he mentioned every election and will be in doubt in the future. I think that's the point.
He's the governor, by the way, who approved the gerrymandered right-wing legislature's attempt to hand all of the governor's power over to the state legislature after he had lost his re-election bid, I think 8 years ago now, to Democrat Roy Cooper. So, yeah, If even McCrory is saying, no, this thing is over, then it seems like it should be over. Rick Hassan, the UCLA Law School election law expert, agreed, posting last night, quote, the idea of retroactively changing the rules for which ballots should count and applying those retroactive rules just selectively in places where the challenging candidate expects to gain relative votes sure is unconstitutional in any election system that values the rule of law. We'll see if North Carolina's does. The only surprise, he says, and disappointment here is that the North Carolina Supreme Court was willing to bless this attempted election subversion. As noted, Judge Myers has given Judge Griffin, who sits on the North Carolina State Court of Appeals, 7 days to appeal this ruling. That means that the ruling may not be, the ruling from Monday, may not be the end of the case. We will see. In a statement on Monday after the ruling, Justice Riggs declared, quote, today we won. I'm proud to continue upholding the Constitution and the rule of law as North Carolina's Supreme Court Justice. So, is that the end to this long and absurd election challenge? Well, that remains to be seen. I'm hoping so, if only because I'm getting kind of tired of telling this story. But it does show you how far some Republicans, if there was any question about it, are willing to go to disenfranchise voters if they can in order to cling to or to gain power via elections. I have zero doubt, none, that it would have been Donald Trump making that very same argument about those very same voters had he lost in North Carolina last year, or in Pennsylvania, or in Wisconsin, or Michigan, etc. Because, hey, disenfranchising thousands of voters, well, that worked for George W. Bush, didn't it? To steal the presidency back in 2000. So why not run the same playbook, no matter how much it stands to undermine democracy and the Constitution itself? That was the lesson from 2000, it seems to me. Worked for George Bush. He got two terms. Even this case might not end the possibility of, even if it stops here, we could see it all happening again in the future. The Times notes that, quote, if Judge Myers' ruling stands, it'll bring closure to an election purgatory that lasted nearly 6 months. But election experts warn that the extraordinary series of challenges from Judge Griffin, as well as an openness from the courts, at least the GOP-controlled state courts, to entertain the lawsuits, that has already created a blueprint for future efforts to overturn elections, according to the Times. We will see. Hopefully, democracy wins this one, at least. Paul Shoemaker, a veteran Republican strategist in Raleigh, North Carolina, who consulted Griffin during his campaign, said in a text to the Times on Monday that, quote, the legal team is reviewing and evaluating next steps.
Wow. I mean, Republicans in every state that they control are acting to continue to block voting rights. So, you know, it's very important to pay attention to your state, especially your state, but also local representation, because your rights are at stake.
Speaking of rights, the constitutional right to due process specifically, which played a part in that North Carolina case, even though Trump over the weekend, as we discussed a little bit on yesterday's show, said he wasn't sure. He wasn't sure if due process was actually mandatory for him to follow, despite the oath that he swore just over 100 days ago when he was sworn in to his second term of office to, quote, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution.
Your Secretary of State says everyone who's here, citizens and non-citizens, deserve due process. Do you agree, Mr. President?
I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know.
Well, the Fifth Amendment says,
I don't know.
Much.
It might say that, but if you're talking about that, then we'd have to have 1 million or 2 million or 3 million trials. We have thousands of people that are some murderers and some drug dealers and some of the worst people on earth.
But if
some of the worst, most dangerous people on earth. And I was elected to get them the hell out of here, and the courts are holding me from doing it.
But even given those numbers that you're talking about, Don't you need to uphold the Constitution of the United States as president?
I don't know. I have to respond by saying again, I have brilliant lawyers that work for me, and they are going to obviously follow what the Supreme Court said. What you said is not what I heard the Supreme Court said. They have a different interpretation.
Actually, no, they don't. They mandated, in fact, in a ruling just weeks ago, that all migrants who are snatched up and detained by Trump's immigration goons under his invocation of the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 must, in fact, be given time, due process, to challenge their detention in court. They must be given due process, according to the Supreme Court, before they are disappeared to a forever gulag in El Salvador. That part of their ruling, at least, was quite clear. I'm not a lawyer either, but I know how to read. In any event, the merits of Trump's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act itself to detain and deport migrants has not yet been ruled on by the U.S. Supreme Court. The 18th century law allows such actions in cases only where a foreign nation has declared war against the United States or where there is a, quote, invasion or predatory incursion of the U.S. at the direction of a foreign government. Trump and Republicans have claimed that members of Venezuela's Tren de Aragua, or TDA gang, have invaded the U.S. at the direction of the Venezuelan government, which is ridiculous, and can therefore be detained and deported under the AEA without due process. But as we discussed a week or three ago, as initially reported from various sources, including the New York Times and the Washington Post, an assessment by the U.S. intelligence community, a whole bunch of our intel agencies working together, they all found, with one small exception, that Venezuela had not ordered Tren de Aragua gang members to invade the U.S. in hopes of undermining it. But those reports at the time, of course, as detailed and as credible as they appeared to be, they were all based on sources who described the findings of the intelligence agencies. Well, now, a memo from those agencies, at least in declassified form, has actually been released for everyone to read. And as the Times reported last night, a newly declassified memo released on Monday confirms the U.S. intelligence agencies rejected a key claim that Donald Trump put forth to justify invoking the wartime statute to summarily deport Venezuelans to a prison in El Salvador. The memo states that spy agencies do not believe that the administration of Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, controls the criminal gang Tren de Aragua. That determination contradicts precisely what Trump has asserted when he invoked the deportation law, the Alien Enemies Act. While Venezuela, quote, while Venezuela's permissive environment enables TDA to operate, the Maduro regime probably does not have a policy of cooperating with TDA, and it is not directing TDA movement to and operations in the United States, according to the memo. The memo's release further undercuts the Trump administration's rationale for using the Alien Enemies Act and calls into question its forceful criticism of the ensuing coverage. After the Times had published its previous article on this back in March, the Justice Department opened a criminal investigation and portrayed the reporting as misleading and harmful. Well, turns out it wasn't misleading, though it was obviously harmful to the administration and their efforts to lie to the American people about their unlawful, unconstitutional deportation policy. The administration doubled down a month later after similar coverage in the Washington Post, according to the Times, citing the disclosures in both articles as a reason to relax the limits on leak investigations. The document, known as a sense of community memo, was released by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, that's Tulsi Gabbard's office, in response to a Freedom of Information request by the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Lauren Harper, the Daniel Ellsberg Chair on Government Secrecy for the Foundation, said the memo was at odds with the administration's portrayal of its contents as a dire threat to public safety if it was to be released. Again, not a dire threat to public safety to release this memo, but a dire threat to Trump's lies about his own unlawful policies, perhaps. Harper continued, quote, the declassification proves that the material should have been public from the start, not used as an excuse to suppress sharing information with the press. It is outrageous, said Tulsi Gabbard. It is outrageous that as President Trump and his administration work hard every day to make America safe by deporting these violent criminals, some in the media remain intent on twisting and manipulating intelligence assessments to undermine the president's agenda to keep the American people safe. Tulsi Gabbard, the director of national intelligence, in a statement. But there is nothing twisted here at all other than Trump and Gabbard's and the rest of the administration's attempts to lie about sending people off to a gulag for life with no due process. Even though, as we all now know, many of them should never have been sent away, even for the reasons that were claimed by the administration. A whole bunch of them don't even appear to be involved with Tren de Aragua. The Alien Enemies Act appears to require a link to a foreign government, notes the New York Times. Trump declared that TDA had committed crimes to destabilize the United States, quote, at the direction, clandestine or otherwise, of the Maduro regime in Venezuela. But the Times reported days later that the intel community had circulated findings back at the end of February, reaching the opposite conclusion. The assessment, shared by a whole bunch of U.S. intel agencies, was that the Venezuelan government and the gang were actually adversaries, even though some corrupt Venezuelan officials had ties to some of the gang members. It also said that the gang lacked any centralized command and control. It was too disorganized to carry out any instructions, much less an invasion of the United States. The Times also reported that only the FBI partly dissented and thought that there was maybe some kind of link, but it was based on information the other agencies like the CIA and the NSA thought was not actually credible information. About a dozen intelligence agencies in full had otherwise come to a consensus on this matter, according to the previous reporting, with the FBI being the only outlier and only partially so. The day after the initial Times article was published, Todd Blanche, the former defense lawyer for Donald Trump, who's now deputy attorney general, he said the DOJ had opened a criminal leak into the investigation. He criticized the article, saying the information in it was classified, but also, quote, inaccurate. But the declassified memo, in fact, supports the original reporting. In an interview on Megyn Kelly's podcast just last week, Tulsi Gabbard said that the reporting on the intel community's conclusions was, quote, being investigated. Leakers had, quote, selectively and intentionally left out the most important thing, she added, pointing to the FBI's belief that some in the Maduro government may be supporting the gang's activities in the U.S. But the articles in both the Times and the Post discussed the FBI's contrary view. Last month, Attorney General Pam Bondi wrote in a memo that she would roll back protections for press freedoms after this. In leak investigations, citing the Times and the Post's articles on this as damaging examples of leaks of classified information. Well, damaging maybe, again, to the administration, but not apparently to anything else. But they hope to use this, it seems, to start detaining and deporting journalists as well to lifetime gulags in El Salvador without due process, I guess. Who's to say that I am not acting at the direction of Venezuela's corrupt president to overthrow the United States, after all? Maybe I am. But here, with Bondi's suggestion that the espionage case could be used against journalists in this matter, really? In an Espionage Act case, prosecutors must prove that someone knowingly made an unauthorized disclosure of defense-related information that could harm the U.S. or aid a foreign adversary. The government's declassification of the memo raises questions about any case that could be brought over the Times and Post articles. But hopefully there is no question about that law as well, given that Donald Trump himself should know it pretty well. As you might recall, Donald Trump was indicted for criminal felony violations of the Espionage Act before the case against him was ultimately dismissed because he won the presidency again about 6 months ago, despite his record of felony indictments and 34 felony convictions in cases where he, at least, did receive constitutional due process. One more story here related before we get to our break, as yet another judge finds against Trump's use of the Alien Enemies Act. Kate Riga reported on Tuesday afternoon at TPM that as judges begin to rule on the merits of Trump's use of the Alien Enemies Act to give him wide latitude to expel alleged Venezuelan gang members, the administration is starting to rack up loss after loss after loss. A federal judge in the Southern District of New York on Tuesday enjoined the administration from moving any detainees being held in the district. Quote, since respondents have not demonstrated the existence of a war, invasion, or predatory incursion, the AEA was not validly invoked by the president. Judge Alvin Hellerstein wrote. He noted that his findings echoed other judges, including a Trump appointee in Texas just last week, as we reported here at the time. Hellerstein is a Clinton appointee. He let his apparent disgust with Trump's administration actions permeate his ruling. Quote, the destination El Salvador, a country paid to take our aliens, is neither the country from which the aliens came nor to which they wish to be removed, but they are taken there and there to remain indefinitely in a notoriously evil jail, unable to communicate with counsel, family, or friends, he wrote. When analyzing the detainees' potential for being harmed if they are moved, he pointed to Kilmar Abrego Garcia, noting that he still has not been returned to the U.S. despite the Supreme Court ruling that directed the administration to facilitate his return. Quote, here, absent a preliminary injunction, petitioners would be removed from the U.S. to CECOT, where they would endure abuse and inhumane treatment with no recourse to bring them back, said the judge, referring to the mega prison in El Salvador. If that is not irreparable harm, what is? Good point, Judge. He also found the administration's proposed notice to the detainees about their impending removal was insufficient under the Supreme Court's ruling and constitutional due process. For example, they were supposed to be given instructions in both Spanish and English. Apparently they weren't. They weren't even told where they were being sent before they were loaded onto planes. Quote, petitioners have not given notice of what they allegedly did to join TDA, when they joined, and what they did in the U.S. or anywhere else to share or further the illicit objectives of the TDA, said Hellerstein. Without such proof, petitioners are subject to removal by the executive's dictate alone, in contravention of the Alien Enemies Act and the constitutional requirements of due process. This nation, he noted, was founded on the self-evident truths that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, Hellerstein wrote. The reminder ringing grim in this context. Quote, our Constitution embodies these truths in a limited government of enumerated powers in its system of checks and balances separating the executive, legislative, and judicial branches, and in its guarantee that neither citizen nor alien be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law.
Your Secretary of State says everyone who's here, citizens and non-citizens, deserve due process. Do you agree, Mr. President?
I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know.
Well, if you didn't know before, which you did, now you definitely do. You liar. Hey, this is Brad. Here at the Bradcast and bradblog.com, we fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to do it. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate to make an automated monthly pledge of any amount you like, or even just a one-time only contribution to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. The fight for voting rights, civil rights, and to save our planet continues. Please help us continue that fight independently over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate right now. Go ahead, do it right now. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Yes, we will get to our latest green news report in a moment or two, but yes. I do want to hit a few green-ish stories quickly first. This website called Splinter, do you know this website, Des?
Yes, I do.
They really, really seem to hate Elon Musk, it seems to me.
Yes, they do. They're very snarky.
But what's not to hate after all? As Splinter's Jacob Weindling reports today, Elon Musk, a man who made two Nazi salutes at Trump's presidential inauguration, thinks it's, quote, outrageous to, quote, claim that I'm a Nazi. And who could blame him? Who among us has not shared posts blaming the Holocaust not on Hitler, but on public workers? It's perfectly natural to tell Germany's far-right political party just classified as, quote, extremist party by Germany's spy agency to, quote, move beyond the country's guilt over killing 6 million Jews on the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, as apparently Elon Musk has done. Well, apparently, Twitter's former users think that, yes, Elon Musk has gone too far. Apparently, use of Twitter, now X.com, total visits to the site are way, way down since Musk went all in for Donald Trump and the far right. According to Business Insider today, the site is now looking for a PR guru to rebuild its horrible image, notes Weindling. But as one PR person quipped to Business Insider, quote, it certainly would be the challenge of a lifetime. This is because, says Weindling, no matter what kind of PR spin any competent human tries to put on Musk's site, this is Musk's site, and his terminal posting brain will always make him Twitter's communications leader, no matter who they hire to do PR. He says you can see that in Elon's feed as he tries to stay on a positive message by reposting posts like Starship will get us to Mars in our lifetime and cute videos of a fox being brushed. But then scroll up a little more and you'll see a repost of the latest blood libel from Fox News or End Wokeness trying to demonize immigrants to help Donald Trump eliminate the very concept of due process. That Musk thinks he can hire some PR expert to undo the damage that he gleefully does to the site on a daily basis reinforces how his brain never evolved past the sixth grade, and he has a child's conception of the world. Twitter users are fleeing en masse because of it, because most people hate Elon Musk's guts and will love to see nothing more than for him to fail in every respect of his life. I think the Splinter folks, they really don't like this guy.
They have some opinions.
He concludes, luckily for this majority, we have Elon Musk on our side, helping the cause of hating Elon and Twitter circling the drain entirely due to his mismanagement. It is a beautiful thing to watch unfold, he says. But Twitter is not the only thing that Musk owns that continues to seem like it is circling the drain. More terrible news for Tesla today. It's been a recurring theme on this show in recent months, it seems. You may already know that Tesla's share price has fallen more than 40% since last December when Musk was tapped to run the so-called Doge scam for Trump. The company has fallen, its stock price has fallen more than 25% since Trump was sworn in January. But sales of the company's cars in Europe in particular have fallen even more. As reported by Reuters today, Tesla's new car sales in Britain and Germany plummeted in April, falling 62% and 46% year on year, respectively, in each of the two countries, even as demand for electric vehicles rose in both countries. Sales of billionaire Elon Musk's EV cars also plunged to multi-year lows in some other European markets last month, according to national data. The brand's sales, however, in Germany dropped to just 885 cars in April, a fourth month of declines this year, amounting to a cumulative year-to-date drop of more than 60%. Britain had bucked the gloomy European trend for Tesla so far this year, but last month, just 512 new cars were sold for Tesla in April. They sold almost three times as many cars as that in April of last year. Overall, car sales in Germany dropped about 0.2% in April, but those of electric vehicles actually spiked by 53.5%. In Britain, battery electric car registration also increased by more than 8% in the month, even while total car sales were down almost 10.5%. So car sales are down, but EV sales are up in both Germany and Britain, just not for Tesla. And all thanks to Musk's horrible politics. Volkswagen's battery electric sales in the UK jumped 194% last month. Registration of China's BYD vehicles were up 311%. And while I don't know if you've heard of BYD yet, the Chinese company is actually now the largest seller of electric vehicles on the planet. They surpassed Tesla about a year or so ago, and they are becoming much better known. But Business Insiders is piling on today to point out, as they do in their headline, that, quote, Tesla just got overtaken in the UK by two Chinese brands you never heard of. And they're right. I never heard of these companies, but they're outselling Tesla. Insider reports, as others do, how Tesla has flatlined in Britain, while BYD saw a 650% increase in UK sales in April. But they note that Tesla...
650% increase.
Yeah. But Tesla was also left in the dust, not just by BYD, but by the lesser-known Chinese car makers JQ and Omoda. Ever heard of them?
I have not heard of them.
I have not heard of them either. They are apparently both owned by a Chinese conglomerate named Chery, and the sales for each of the brands in April was more than twice than it was for Tesla. Despite these companies launching in the UK only last year, Business Insider notes today getting lapped by two virtually unknown Chinese car makers is a sign of just how much trouble Tesla now faces in Europe, its third biggest market. The automaker is facing collapsing sales across the continent amid a backlash over Musk's politics, the billionaire's endorsement to the far-right German party AfD, and his advisory role with the Trump administration have sparked protests in several European cities, with Tesla vehicles and showrooms being hit by vandalism over there, just as we have seen over here. Tesla's European brand crisis, they note, shows little sign of abating. Sad,
Consumers are voting with their wallets. Oops.
Anyway, to cheer us all up, it is our latest edition of Desi Doyen and the Green News Report.
It most assuredly will affect the availability, the frequency, and the accuracy, quite honestly, of the warnings.
Drastic cuts to National Weather Service endanger public safety, former weather chiefs warn. Trump Justice Department sues four states to block climate laws and lawsuits. Plus, Trump moves to open up the seafloor to mining and shrink national monuments.
All of Trump's shrinkage and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Look, you don't understand. There was shrinkage.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, let the devastation begin. What do you got for us on today's Green News Report?
Well, first, CNN reports that U.S. weather forecasting is more crippled than previously known due to the Trump administration's deep budget cuts and mass layoffs at the National Weather Service. Current and former agency meteorologists say they are concerned that forecasts and life-saving warnings won't be issued in time, particularly concerning with hurricane season starting on June 1st. Oh. On Monday, all five living former National Weather Service leaders released an open letter warning that their, quote, worst nightmare is that the cuts will lead to needless loss of life. For example, the National Weather Service office in Goodland, Kansas, Tornado Alley, is no longer operating 24 hours a day, virtually unheard of in tornado season.
Really?
Yes.
They're no longer checking for tornadoes at night,
I guess.
Unbelievable.
In science, atmospheric CO2 jumped in 2024 by an unusually large amount, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Atmospheric CO2 has been increasing rapidly since humanity began burning coal and oil. Scientists are concerned because they can't fully explain why 2024 saw such a big spike in emissions, telling Inside Climate News that it might be a sign that nature's carbon absorbers, forests, fields, and wetlands are taking up less of humanity's carbon pollution, and that is a problem.
A big problem.
In related news, the Trump Justice Department has sued four states to stop them from holding fossil fuel companies liable for billions of dollars in climate-related damages, claiming that the actions conflict with federal authority. Multiple investigations have revealed that the oil industry knew since at least the 1950s that fossil fuels cause dangerous global warming and deceived the public and lawmakers for decades about it. The Trump DOJ is suing Hawaii and Michigan to block their climate liability lawsuits, and the agency is challenging climate superfund state laws in Vermont and New York that require fossil fuel companies to pay fees for carbon emissions into state-based funds.
Well, I guess when you pay the president of the United States enough money, well, the fossil fuel industry can look forward to his protection via federal law.
Hawaii's state legislature just passed legislation raising taxes on hotel rooms to generate revenue to pay for climate damages. Meanwhile, the Trump Interior Department is working on plans to shrink the boundaries of at least six national monuments in the U.S. West to open them up for oil and gas development. Scientists are also sounding the alarm over a recent Trump executive order aimed at opening up the deep sea floor to mining in both U.S. and international waters, bypassing ongoing international negotiations to establish standards for mining in the incredibly fragile deep sea ecosystem.
International laws and standards are for suckers, I guess.
Deep sea ecologist Cheryl Murdoch, in an interview with NPR, agrees with you.
This is just going to say, you know, the U.S. is going to stake claim to a part of international waters that is supposed to be for the benefit of all humankind and say, no, this part is ours and we're going to do what we like with it.
Yep, that's my Trump administration.
Finally, a coalition of 18 states on Monday sued the Trump administration back.
Good.
Over its attempt to stop the development of wind energy. The lawsuit challenges Trump's executive order that paused approvals, permits, and loans for all wind energy projects in the United States, both onshore and offshore. The coalition argues that Trump doesn't have the authority to unilaterally shut down the permitting process, and that his actions pose an existential threat to the growing industry, jeopardizing development of a clean power source critical to economic growth and competitiveness, public health, and climate goals.
That sounds like my Trump, too. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us, please, planet-wide on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Yes, some mighty winds are blowing across the land and across the sea. It's blowing peace and freedom. It's blowing equality. Yes, it's blowing peace and freedom. It's blowing you and me.
Yes.
That's the best song ever.
I know we're working blue today in the Green News Report. Sorry about that. Or you're welcome, however you may see it. Anyway, thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is always an honor. It is always appreciated. If you missed any portion of today's show, want to hear it again, share it with those you know, love, or hate, you can do so anytime for free at bradblog.com. Thanks to those of you who hit a donate button while you're over there. We could really use the support to help us stay on your public airwaves for as long as we can. It is not easy right now for independent media folks like ourselves. So thanks in advance. You can also go to bradblog.com/donate. Please feel free to drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, particularly Blue Sky, you will find me at The Brad Blog. Please find, follow, and share if you don't mind. All right, that's it. We'll see you there at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.